Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So crime in the United States is obviously a huge problem. Many people feel like it's a solvable problem, but it's something that we refuse to take action on. In contrast, many people have looked to El Salvador and the way that their new president, Nayib Bukele, has changed the face of El Salvador. Large amounts of gangs put into prison. The crime rate has dropped very rapidly, and a lot of people wonder if this can be applied to us. But of course, there are a lot of different dynamics. We want to learn more about the man himself, how he rose to power, what he exactly did, and most importantly, what we can learn. And somebody who just wrote a great piece about this was Ben Braddock. He's a editor over at the publication IM1776, and he's joined me today to talk about it. Ben, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So I think a lot of people, like I said, are going to look at Bukele and say immediately, oh, we should just copy him. We should just be able to do exactly what he did. But I think there's a whole important set of circumstances that brought him to power and allowed him to take the actions that he did. And I want to dive into that with you because I think it's easy for people to just kind of try to one-to-one this to our situation. But I think it's important to understand a little bit of the background before we just try to apply these situations to every given country. But before we dive into all that, guys, I want to tell you real quick about your moral duty to hire based people through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to talk to you about New Founding. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find employees to get the work done. And that's why you need access to the New Founding Network. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. They're individuals, often in elite organizations, who are ready for a team and mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using the network to hire high-trust, exceptional individuals who match the culture and mission of their team. You can apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll be connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Go there now to find your next hire. All right, Ben. So I think a lot of people are familiar with this issue just because they saw this massive amount of very tattooed up gang members all being run into these prisons, all being locked up simultaneously. But they probably don't have a lot of background about what actually happened in El Salvador. It's just a South American country that happens to have a lot of crime. Why were they in this situation? Why are the gangs so prevalent there? Is it just drugs, or are there other dynamics in play?
Well, you have to go back with what happened in the 1980s with the civil war there. It was extremely violent and displaced over a million people, led to a mass exodus, primarily to the United States. Some parents went ahead and left their kids in the care of relatives while they got established in places like Los Angeles, the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Very poor people, you know, going to the poorest, most dysfunctional parts of America in the 1980s, which, American cities were ganglands back then, right? Especially like Los Angeles. That was when the crack boom was underway. And, you know, these new arrivals, they get there and they're at the bottom rung. Like, they're being treated badly by the Mexicans, who saw them as like poorer and dirtier and browner. So they're, you know, very much in a very desperate ghetto type situation. And, you know, some of the kids were then like left back in El Salvador until their parents could send for them. And that separation from their parents, that caused its own set of issues for a lot of these kids. When they finally, you know, were reunited in the United States, they're in an alien culture. Their parents are somewhat strangers to them in many cases. Their siblings, who are U.S. born, also very different to them. They, you know, by and large, speak very little English, if any at all. And, you know, of course, their parents being first generation immigrants on the lowest rung of the ladder, mostly worked these service jobs like being, you know, nannies and construction and house cleaners and this sort of thing. So parents working 12, 16 hours a day. And so the kids were put into the school system, which functioned, the public school system in Los Angeles, at least in those parts of Los Angeles, functions as like these daycare centers for the ghetto and are pretty much just jail for kids. Yeah. But they're also, you know, because you have these different ethnicities in there together, primarily Black, Mexican, and then Salvadoran, add that to the mix, there's this tendency to form these ethnic factions, so these ethnic gangs. And so MS-13 really was born from a lot of the just the ethnic conflict of being in that situation. And so it started as a Salvadoran gang. The earliest origins was actually as like a club of kids who would get together and, you know, smoke pot and listen to heavy metal music. The heavy metal influence seems to be what kind of led to there being also this satanic element. You know, throughout the history of MS-13, there's a lot of devil worship that went on, human sacrifices to Satan. Former gang members interviewed saying they actually saw Satan appear in the corner. You know, they believe that the more innocent the victim, the better of an offering it was, and they would get these powers in exchange for doing this. They believe that the ultimate sacrifice that you can make to the devil would be to kill an unborn child, because they were not touched by original sin, you know, not having been born yet. So just really, some really dark stuff ended up emerging from it. But it started, you know, as this kind of, you know, kids getting kind of banding together and, you know, being just like a kind of a normal street gang, of which there were a lot of in Los Angeles and a lot of American cities at the time. Well, fast forward to the 90s, after the Civil War was concluded, and both sides, both the far right ARENA party, the Nationalist, and the far left FMLN, Communist Guerrillas, they agreed to hold each other unaccountable for any atrocities committed by either side during the war, and set up a political system in which they were the two parties in power. And so once the war was concluded, President Clinton began deporting many of the Salvadorans who were in the U.S. back to El Salvador, but without telling the Salvadoran authorities when these members or when these Salvadorans were gang members, you know, and had been picked up for violent crime or theft or whatever. So, you know, the Salvadoran government thought that they were just getting back, you know, a bunch of Salvadoran refugees. And they were getting some of them, but among them was a lot of people who had already, you know, turned to a life of crime or had gotten involved in one of these criminal gangs that, you know, had by that time had turned into something pretty violent and pretty, you know, it's always been loosely organized, but, you know, pretty distinct away from its origins. It was definitely flavored a lot by its contact and kind of alliances with some of the Mexican mafia. So it was over the course of some of these gang members in the 80s being picked up for various crimes and spending time in jail that they had contact with members of the Mexican mafia, who kind of taught them how to like professionalize themselves as gangsters. So this leads to a situation in the 2000s where, you know, the gangs rapidly expanded there locally in El Salvador, because even though the war was over, there was still, you know, a hopeless economic situation, a government that both sides looted from the people, and, you know, plenty of opportunities for them to recruit, which is usually under pressure, young boys into the gang. So that created the nexus for there being a strong gang presence, and they just established themselves so well. There was never a government that was strong enough to really drive them out. And they had their hands, the Salvadoran governments had their hands tied by the United States foreign policy apparatus. So one of the conditions of U.S. aid was that Salvador had to adopt U.S. style criminal justice policies. One of them being that if you were a minor, you couldn't be held responsible for a criminal act. Right. Well, you know, when you're recruiting 12 and 13 year old boys to do most of your hits, and really that incentivized it, right, to where they would just use younger gang members who were minors. They would use them to commit the worst crimes so that they couldn't be charged with it. And there were a couple of administrations in the early 2000s that had made attempts. There was the Mano Duro policies of one of the Arena presidents that for a time seemed to reduce the violence, but then the criminal justice system just let most of these people back on the streets. So they arrested a lot of gang members, enough to make a big dent in the homicide rate. But then they were, you know, essentially forced by their constitutional system to release them. So it was this long simmering problem. You had, I think it was President Mauricio Funes who had actually made deals with the gangs. He was an FMLN president in the late 00s. He made a deal with the gangs to reduce violence in exchange for kind of political support. And, you know, I think at one point, some of the other FMLN politicians were cutting deals for the gangs to provide votes. In a pretty open display of Latin American leftist parties liking to use like criminals as their street goons. And it's becoming, I think, much more of a thing in the United States now. You saw it in the last election with the DNC and, you know, Kamala Harris promoting bail funds for rioters.
Yeah, I was going to say, oh, thank God we don't see that in the United States, you know, a civilized country. So we have this, you know, we have basically this diaspora during the Civil War. It creates, interestingly enough, a lot of these kids come to the United States. They get a taste of the melting pot. And because of the way that the public school system functions here and the racial divides, they create this kind of hostility, form these gangs, get an education in more vicious tactics from other gangs. And when they filter back into El Salvador, ironically, they bring even more of that violence with them, and they then become a dominant force inside the country because the politicians aren't legally allowed to deal with them, mainly because of outside influences like the United States leaning on their criminal justice system. Obviously, this is a mess that sets El Salvador up as basically the murder capital of the world for a number of years. So this is the situation that Bukele's stepping into. But as I understand, he didn't begin as some kind of right-wing authoritarian that, you know, many people would paint him in. He actually starts in left-wing politics. So can you explain how he came onto the scene?
Yeah, so he started his career in the FMLN, which was the leftist party. His father had been, I think, friendly with them for much of the history. Leading up to that, it was, I think it was kind of a comfortable fit as far as like the, you know, position that they were in Salvadoran society, just the kind of people who were in Arena, it's, you know, they wouldn't make, someone like Bukele welcome among them. He's not a member of the, good old boys club, kind of like, it would be, you know, kind of like if a new right person tried to, ingratiate themselves in like the GOP of the 90s, you know, like Pat Buchanan, they spit you right out. So, he first ran for mayor of a small municipality called Nuevo Cuscutlan with the FMLN. He was very popular there. He governed as kind of centrist, programs like just cleaning up parks and, you know, building new libraries and a new municipal market for, you know, food sellers and stuff that would normally be on the street. And he was, you know, so popular there that he was been a plausible candidate for the mayor of the capital city, San Salvador. And so he ran in that election and was wildly popular, got in fairly easily, and, you know, also for being really young. I mean, he's like 40, right? And this was some years ago. Yeah, people just gravitated toward him. He has a certain charisma that he's just is always connected to voters and citizens, and has been able to, like, cut through the left and the right and just deliver a kind of common sense, you know, somewhat of a non-ideological perspective, right? Just describing reality as it was kind of evident to everyone. And as mayor of San Salvador, he was enormously popular. Carried out a number of projects that the people of the city just were really appreciative for. One was beginning the revitalization of the historic downtown. So they have a historic downtown area that it's where, you know, the National Cathedral is, many of the legislative buildings. It would be like the Federal Triangle of Washington, D.C., you know, where your seat of government is, and a lot of beautiful old architecture from the period. And it's like a kind of classic Spanish architecture, really, really nice. But that area was allowed to fall into horrible disrepair for decades. And the streets had been taken over by people who had built like these plywood shanty store type things. So it felt like you were in, I don't know, like a market in Nairobi or something, just this completely chaotic environment. And it was also extremely dangerous. It was like, it was where, you know, just the most hard up people would kind of gather and flock to this area. So he went in and he cleaned that out. Like, he restored the, you know, the concept of sidewalks, and you could drive down the road, this kind of stuff. And so businesses started coming back to that, and it's become more and more vitalized. There's the new National Library is there, this gleaming five-story building. A lot of new businesses and restaurants and other projects are coming in. And so as mayor, you know, he was very successful and very popular. And historically, the mayor of El Salvador, like, that's the best position to launch a campaign for president. And he ended up getting into a dispute with his own party. He was criticizing party leadership, their strategy, a lot of those things. He was in the FMLN party, but he wasn't so much of it. And the old guard who ran the party, they began to get nervous because it became evident that they couldn't control this guy. He was enormously popular, very talented, would be a shoe-in for the presidency in the next round, but he couldn't be controlled by the party. So that led to him being kicked out of the party. Very extraordinary thing to think of is, you know, if you have like your leading presidential candidate, you're almost assured to take the presidency of a country, but you kick the person out of the party because they're too independent. And that scares you.
Not that hard to imagine, actually, given our current country. But yeah,
you see a lot of parallels actually between our own system and theirs. Right. Theirs is just a little more open. But when President Bukele, or then Mayor Bukele, had announced that he was going to run for president, he started a new party, the Nuevas Ideas Party, New Ideas, that was neither left nor right in terms of ideology. You would describe it as more of a technocratic, just a, you know, common sense centrist approach, focusing on, you know, what works more so than dogma, or and not really tied to like historical ideological figures or traditions, this sort of thing. It was just a, you know, new ideas. That's kind of the basis of the party, right? That party was disqualified by the Supreme Court for elections. So they have like a special court that's like just if we had a Supreme Court, but if they only dealt with election matters. Brazil has something similar.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah. And that court disqualified his party from being able to compete in the election, even though it met the statutory requirements to become a party in the election. So then he goes to this small center-left party that had been part of the coalition that had supported him when he ran for mayor and worked out a deal with them to become their candidate because they had ballot access. It would be kind of like if you were, you know, if you tried to start a new party in America, you were disqualified from being able to run on our ballot and you went with the libertarians and was like, you know, nominate me, I'll run on, I'll be your standard bearer. So he does this, but the night before the filing deadline, the Supreme Court for elections meets in private and decides among themselves. And the court was made up of the old right-wing and left-wing parties, so FMLN and ARENA. Their judges get together and decide to disqualify this party, even though it had qualified in previous elections, several previous elections, and you know met the qualifications to qualify for that one too. It was they met around 7 p.m., started the discussions. By 9 p.m., though, someone there had leaked to Bukele's camp what was going on. So Bukele then, and you know, midnight is the deadline. It was around 11:30. He changes his party. You know, in the space of a couple hours, had worked out a deal with a different party, a center-right party, who also qualified for the ballot, to become their nominee. And so he changes it, changes the paperwork, but waits until the judges have announced that he was disqualified, which they did in a press conference the next day. He's disqualified because he's running on this center-left party line. To then reveal, no, actually, I'm running on the center-right party line, and you didn't disqualify that party. So, you know, see you in November, boys. That was, you know, this. That's a very underreported aspect too. Like you hear very little of this. You know, even from guys on our side, I didn't uncover that with much of the commentary that I had read. And it was details like that that, in part, was what motivated me to write. The story I did, because I wanted to get the full picture and show that, you know, this guy didn't just walk into the presidency. He had to outmaneuver and wheel and deal his way into it.
Yeah, I think that's a theme that is really important, because like you said, whether you're looking at Bolsonaro in Brazil or Trump here in the United States, we have a consistent theme of these outsiders, you know, well-liked, but maybe not inside the normal political framework. They're promising, you know, to bring something that the establishment doesn't want, to, you know, play a game that's not approved. And you have basically the entire system working endlessly while talking about the importance of democracy to make sure that these people are, it's impossible for them to run at every turn. And it seems like we're seeing that play out not just in the courts, but in the media. And so I think you're exactly right to say that it's critical people understand kind of the lengths he had to go to just to put himself on a ticket where he would have the opportunity to make the case for what he ended up doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, once he gets in, it wasn't overnight that he was able to get control of the problem. You know, there was a plan, the territorial control plan, and, you know, has several distinct phases. And so they were, you know, they were really doing everything. It wasn't just a law enforcement only kind of approach. There was also, you know, trying to, you know, divert kids from joining the gangs in the first place. That's one of the things that, you know, a lot of his detractors have said, well, you know, there's these other more systemic issues that need to be addressed, and that's how you fight crime. But he didn't neglect those. you know, the schools and education kind of approach that like the Colombian president has told him he should follow instead. It's just that he didn't also wait for those to pay off 30 years. He recognized that the situation as it was incredibly violent. You know, El Salvador having the highest homicide rate in the country, in the world. Now it's the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. It's on par with Luxembourg. But for that to happen, it wasn't quite as simple as I've seen some people say. It's like, well, you just go and arrest the criminals. It's like, well, okay, but how do you do that? One of the steps they had to take that was really key was to make sure that the gang leaders who were already in prison were not able to give the orders to start carrying out terrorist attacks in like shopping malls and public streets and this sort of thing. And they had done that. And actually in, I think it was March or April of 2021, very violent day. Some buses were burned. I think over 60 people were killed there in the capital. It was just this sudden, spasm of violence and bloodshed from MS-13. That was, I think, intended to send a message to the Bukele administration, you know, stop pressuring us, stop putting this pressure on us. Like they wanted, I think, to scare Bukele back into the old status quo. Mm-hmm. And instead, Bukele orders, okay, if you do this outside, your homeboys on the inside are going to suffer. So we've cut the rations, you know, and the more people you kill, the less we're going to feed the prisoners. Is that I'm not going to take the food out of the mouths of school children, you know, to give it to criminals. Because someone was saying, well, it's inhuman. One of the international human rights agencies were saying that it was inhumane to feed prisoners meals of rice and beans. And they were like, where's the protein? So the only time these people actually want you to consume meat is if you're
right. if you're a murderer.
They failed to appreciate the enforced vegetarianism. But the, you know, Bukele's perspective was like, look, if the kids in schools are eating rice and beans, right? Like if we can't afford to feed them better than that, why would we feed the prisoners better than the children? And that's been a theme of his administration is the priorities. It's like, who am I elected to serve? You know, like who do you have compassion? And so many of the people who've criticized his approach, you know, they say, well, you put all these people in jail. They're failing to appreciate that the entire country of El Salvador was a prison. You know, they were, people couldn't leave their neighborhoods because of extortion, because of violence. There have been people I've met there that they had barely saw the outside of their house as children, because their moms kept them inside and homeschooled them. You know, but just like, didn't even like want them to go out into the street. You know, that's a prison situation. That's it's not a formal state prison, but if your society is so violent and there's extortion and people trying to recruit your children into gangs and all of this kind of stuff, it's functionally, you know, millions of people were living in a big open air prison. And that is what has been the biggest noticeable change is just how full the streets are and how like the parks have these families walking around, you know, sometimes late at night. And just, there's this tremendous sense of freedom that people are experiencing now, because for the first time in most of their lives, they're able to go out into public and have a normal civic life. Because it's safe. It's just unlocked the key to so much, and people can build businesses, expand businesses, not have to worry about 30% of the daily take having to go to, you know, the extortionist. Used to be that like if your bus driver didn't pay the extortion fee to the gangs, they might shoot everyone on the bus or just set the bus on fire and lock you in it. It was just horrible brutality and violence and terrorism. You know, these these people lived in this constant state of fear. And now that they've been freed from that, you have this country now that it's a great flourishing. Like there's this, this outburst of energy. New sports are becoming popular. Like a lot of people are taking up road biking. So you'll see like these just big packs of bikers going through the cities. You know, the skateboard culture has started to pop up in San Salvador with like tons of kids out skating, going to skate parks, reminiscent of like, you know, 1990s America. And in general, you see a much more involvement in the public spaces there than here in the States, where I feel like we're already adopting like some form of this. What I saw in Brazil, where, you know, people kind of avoid public spaces because you could either be menaced by someone who was mentally ill or mugged. Yeah. You know, at least in our cities with higher crime rates, there's just this kind of bunker mentality that I've noticed in the States. Just people just want to stay in their houses or like drive to specific, you know, stores and strip malls and stuff. But I think there's been a real decline in, you know, people just being out in public spaces here, but then there it's like, it's really heartening to see. And nice to be around and be a part of.
Well, of course, you would expect exactly that. You have this incredible transformation once people don't have to constantly live in fear of every interaction. And it's amazing that, you know, we managed to come up with just infinite number of reasons that we have to live like this. There are all these excuses about, you know, the infinite number of rights that are attributed to horrific people who are just absolutely devastating the community, making it impossible for average people to live. And those average people have none of these rights. None of them are apparently afforded to them. Their well-being is unimportant because somewhere, you know, some Amnesty International, some other organization says, no, you can't lock these people away. And I want to talk about a couple aspects of that. I mean, the first one would be, I imagine in a situation like this, he faced a lot of pushback in perhaps the police or the military, because often in these situations, those organizations are already infiltrated or cowed by the gangs. And so you would think that he's going to see a lot of pushback there. Also, like you said, he had to apply this across the board. It wasn't just the military. It wasn't just the law enforcement aspect. It was addressing education system and all of that. And so I also wonder, you know, was that due to his ability to kind of wield executive power? Did he have a coalition that he had built inside the legislature? What allowed him to make this dynamic change and break out of a system that was so deeply entrenched? It can't just have been attaining the executive office. So what allowed him to make these big changes?
Well, part of it is just enormous personal popularity. So many of the people, including people in government, bought into his message. Like, imagine if like your government employees, down to the level of like someone who works at the DMV, were really inspired by President Trump's in urging to, you know, make America great again. Like if you had the administrative state, if you had like a large swath of it enthusiastic and on board with the idea of revitalizing the country. That's part of it, a big part of it. Another part of it, though, was, you know, recognized early on that one of the big problems that Latin American countries have experienced in policing is that they're very poor countries. They're not bringing in a lot of money, and a lot of the money that they are bringing in gets siphoned off because of corruption. You know, Bukele's slogan when he ran for president was, there's enough money when no one steals. And that was to highlight the corruption in both of the current parties. And, you know, send a message like, we can have good services. We have to cut the fat and we have to spend on what matters. So one of the early things he did, though, was to give a big raise to the national police. So one of the problems with Latin American policing is that there's not that much spent on the salaries. The salaries of a cop in Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, many of these places, it's not enough to really live. you know, like any kind of worthwhile life in exchange for the risk that you're taking on. You know, it's much more dangerous to be a cop in any of these countries, and you're paid much less than an American cop. So by giving a strong raise to the to law enforcement, it was a sign that, you know, I've got your back. I see what you're doing and I appreciate it. And we're going to support you. We're not, you know, we're going to, you know, put you in a position to where you can provide for your family. And, you know, in exchange for that, people were willing to take on the risk, because it is a huge risk to go after these criminals. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they had good spirit already. And, you know, you add someone who comes in and who's genuinely appreciative and supportive, I think the large swaths of law enforcement, they just really felt like, you know, Bukele was sincere, had their back, and they believed in the mission. And he, you know, he would speak to them in these speeches. You can see some of the videos online that's been posted, speaking in very explicitly spiritual tones, right? It's not about, okay, we just want to make I want to do good government, I want to do this, want to do that. He framed it as a battle of good versus evil, and how we are blessed to be instruments of God's will. And that's how we should see ourselves, as instruments of God's will. And that we have, and, you know, so he imbued the mission with this sense of holiness, and, you know, in a sense, like it was a crusade. And that, I think, is another key factor in why you can't just replicate this with a copy paste function, because you have to have someone who is, you know, sincere in their belief, and you have to have a population who has sincere beliefs. You know, El Salvador has the highest rate of church attendance of any country in the world. I think it's over 60% attend church at least once a week. Very strong, both evangelical and Catholic segments of the population, and very faithful. And, you know, a big part of that too is, you know, you can do a lot when you have a country that has this kind of spiritual grounding and belief. And, you know, it's a little harder to, it'd be a little harder to try to replicate that success here in the States, you know, without having a population that, you know, frankly, had been through 40 years of just hell on earth, and they were ready for a big change. You know,
yeah, it's hard.
They gave him the mandate to do anything that needed to be done, including at one point threatening insurrection. Like, he showed up to the National Assembly with a crowd of thousands of people, spoke to the crowd outside, and then walks in, sets in the speaker's chair inside, prays for a few minutes, and then comes outside and tells the crowd that God told him to have patience, and that, you know, insurrection was still on the table, but they could wait a week. That was a very Caesar-esque moment.
Yeah, that's a Chad move right there. Yeah, it's hard not to notice that shift. You know, you talk about the type of gangs that are there, that many in the piece, you talk about the Satanism that many of them are involved in. And, you know, that shift, of course, to a country that is heavily church, the way that they can almost flip on a dime and feel that energy when you kind of have that level of spiritual battle occurring there. It's also hard to not notice that increasingly our Western leaders are very scared of charismatic men with a non-ideological approach that is willing to care more about the, you know, the well-being of the people rather than rely on slogans about specific policy or procedure, and often are invoking faith. That's something that also seems to terrify people on a pretty regular basis. And you really have to wonder, especially even as we look on the American right and how worried they are about the rise of Trump and the fact that he really is stripping away a lot of the ideology that once defined the GOP and the right wing in the United States. It's very hard, as you said, we can't copy and paste this dynamic, But we do see a trend that many of these oligarchic managerial regimes are very scared of the possibility. You know, I think Trump, honestly, is not a Caesar figure, but even the very possibility that a Caesar figure could exist, that they seem to just be apoplectic that this could be forming, and they want to stamp it out everywhere. It's not just in their own countries, but they feel like if someone sees it work somewhere else in the world, it might threaten their own power.
Right. And I think one of the things they didn't account for with their support of open borders and amnesty for the past few decades is that constitutionally speaking, Latin people are, I think, much more likely to follow a charismatic figure like that than, you know, us Nordic or Anglos. You know, in the culture, there's just this desire for a strong Caudillo type figure. And it's why throughout all of Latin history, you've seen these powerful leaders emerge. And there's not a real love of Western liberal democracy among these peoples. So I think a situation in America, like looking at the future, possibly the silver lining to some of the demographic shifts is that, you know, I could easily see a Bukele type figure emerging in an American state, you know, either as a governor or even making it all the way as a presidential type figure. You know, maybe from a Latin background, or maybe, you know, from an American background that you know, is just able to catch that energy. I know in some places already in the States, though, the Salvadorian vote is shifting very hard against the Democrats. They have taken notice of the Biden administration's actions against El Salvador. They dislike it very strongly, and it's kind of opened it has them now looking at other aspects of the Democratic program and saying, wait, this doesn't represent me. There were some local races in Virginia last year. One was in a state Senate race in a district that Biden won by 30 points. The Republican came within a half a point of winning it. And this was a Republican that no one in the state party, the state GOP, believed in. The governor Governor Youngkin did not send him very much money at all. But on the basis of a massive shift among the Salvadoran working class that had been activated by some local grassroots organizers working with pastors there. You know, to have a 30-point swing in voter preference in a, you know, working class Democratic district, that's a very significant shift to make. And I think, you know, for Salvadorans specifically, like there'll be another, I think there are another group add to, you know, in 2020, Trump already had made inroads into the Latino vote to such an extent that it had a big effect on some of the House races. It definitely locked Florida down. And I think as the Biden administration's shown itself to be just really petty, I mean, like the U.S. government used to pay for almost the entirety of El Salvador's security operations. I mean, that was why they were able to tell them, hey, you're going to release them back into the streets. And now they're like, yeah, we're not funding any of this anymore. So like U.S. aid has been, you know, cut significantly. And they're throwing up roadblocks wherever they can. You know, State Department's just actively working to undermine Bukele. So, you know, these actions, I think, you know, we'll see this November, probably some surprises. I think it'll make at least Virginia a lot closer. There's a lot of Salvadoran Americans in Virginia. Especially Northern Virginia. And, you know, whether it's enough to flip the whole state, I don't know, but I think it could make some House races interesting. But I think, you know, I think so, it's like it'll be a country at a time, like the Brazilians, you know, as a result of what's happened with Bolsonaro, like Brazilian Americans specifically now are very strongly right wing in a way that, you know, 10 years ago, they would just vote Democrat without thinking about it. So we are seeing a shift. We'll see how big of an impact it is, but you know, I expect it to be enough to at least make some Democrat consultants sweat and maybe start to think about border security.
So you think the Castizo futurism meme could be real? Because I think a lot of people, rightly so, you know, every time we get to one of these election cycles, they hear about the way the minority vote is going to finally shift in the Republicans' favor, and it's finally, you know, based immigration is finally going to, you know, bring the promised inroads, and we're going to see a dynamic shift, and then that never really materializes. But we did see, for instance, Miami-Dade go red for DeSantis. Like you said, Florida has definitely changed. So it is interesting to think that, you know,
and Trump almost won Miami-Dade in 2020, which was unthinkable. He cleared 40% of the vote there, which was just like, for any long time watchers of Florida and presidential races, that was just like such a key moment. I think the more recent immigrants that have been coming in the last few years, I have no doubt that that is not good for us in any way, shape, or form. I'm thinking mainly of the groups that were coming in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s that, and of course, they're the ones who are starting to become naturalized and entering the voting population and such. I don't go full Castizo futurism, but I think that there are some interesting indicators. And, you know, one of the interesting indicators in the last election was the Rio Grande Valley, which had always been very, very solidly Democrat, like machine Democrat, 90% Democrat margins. And that was a key to Texas being a Democratic state for so long, you know, really until George W. Bush, you know, it was there in the mix. And I think that it's interesting, like these older Mexican families in South Texas that have, you know, been in the country for generations and for so long had been Democrats, you know, them changing their preferences. I mean, at least it ensures that Texas isn't going to flip, which, remember, in 2020, there were indicators that Texas was very competitive for Biden. And a big function of why that wasn't anywhere near true, why Trump did so well, was the Rio Grande Valley voting for Trump in such large numbers. That was totally unexpected. I mean, in some there were some counties down there where the swing was 70 points compared to the 2016 election. So, you know, margins count. You might not win a majority of a population, but it's, in any case, it's always better to have fewer people voting against you. So,
yeah. Well, and, you know, as someone who's lived in South Florida for most of my life, I can tell you that the most reliable thing is the last generation of Hispanic immigrants saying that you need to close the border before the next generation gets there. So
there's also a funny old joke. The numbers may need to be higher anymore because 50,000 isn't worth what it used to be. But the joke was is that if you're Mexican, as soon as you start making 50,000, you become a Republican.
Right. Yeah. It's a very real dynamic. It's something you can observe on a pretty regular basis. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I think that it's a really great piece. People should, of course, check that out and all the other really great pieces that you have over at IM1776. Before we move over to any questions from the audience, do you want to let people know about anything you've got coming up or anywhere else that they can find your work?
Stay tuned for things that'll be coming up. We are working on a futurism issue. It'll be our next print edition. I'm very excited for that. The work that our founder Mark Kranz has done and the in curating and doing layout. I mean, it's really a nice, all the print editions are little works of art, I think. And we'll be working on that. And that hopefully should be shipping sometime in the summer. And go sign up for an IM1776 membership. You get at least two of the print editions every year, plus access to, events, the network, all of that good stuff. So
yeah, they're very nice. I've got the collection on my shelf. All right, guys, let's go over to any questions here. We got Creeper Weirdo says, lockdown of running, what's next? Jailing a political opponent for running? Imagine living in a nation so corrupt and horrible it couldn't be us. Yeah, it is very sad to see all these things that you thought were really just indicative of a third world banana republic type scenario just continually make themselves manifest in the United States, from the criminal street thugs deployed in the election to the active prosecution of anyone who is running against you. It truly is amazing. I was told my entire life that the Constitution protected us from these kind of things, and one of the great realizations that kind of brought me to where I am now is that actually it's the spirit of the people, and only ever the spirit of the people, that actually protects you from this stuff.
I will say, I try to look on the bright side of it. It's good to finally have someone running for public office that is enough of a threat to the establishment that they would bother to try to put him in jail.
That's true. That's very true. That's a good point. Yeah. Very, very unfortunately, at this, Mitt Romney's not going to prison if he tries to run. It's a very different dynamic. So that's very true. All right, guys. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Once again, make sure you're checking out Ben's work everywhere that it's available. And of course, if it's your first time on this YouTube channel, please go ahead and subscribe. You can click the notifications, the bell, and everything to make sure that you can catch these streams when they go live. And of course, if you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you subscribe to the Orrin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you, everybody, for coming by. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.